We'll hear our third case for today, 99-2078, Ariel Putnam v. Time Warner Cable. Mr. Kavanis, you represent the plaintiffs Putnam et al., and you are scheduled not only for the original argument, but 5 minutes for rebuttal. Is that right? Okay. Mr. Carey, not here. Okay, you may proceed.
May it please the court, I'm John Kavanis. I represent the petitioners. We're here following the trial court's dismissal of our complaint without the benefit of discovery, without any evidentiary proceedings, solely on a motion to dismiss. The petitioners believe we're here because the trial court and the Court of Appeals put the cart before the horse in this case. And they did that by jumping to the voluntary payment doctrine without appropriately considering the petitioner's unlawful liquidated damage claim in this case. One of the first issues for this court, we believe, is the public policy issue pointed out by Judge Shutson in his dissent, and that is, as a matter of equity, when you have an unlawful liquidated damage claim, does the voluntary payment doctrine even apply? We don't believe it does. We submit to this court that the public policy reasons behind the voluntary payment doctrine do not apply when you have an unlawful liquidated damage claim. The unlawful liquidated damage claim has been held as a matter of public policy to prevent companies from charging excessive penalties and persons from charging in contracts excessive penalties. The public policy underpinnings of the voluntary payment doctrine, or number one, when you have someone who makes a payment with full knowledge of the facts, the company is entitled to rely on that payment. Does it make any sense from a public policy standpoint, and we have to assume is true in this case, given the posture that it comes to this court, that in fact the late payment fee here was an unlawful liquidated damage? Does it make any sense as a matter of public policy to allow a payee who's by definition charged an unlawful fee to rely on that? We think not, and we suggest to the court not. Number two, even if when we get beyond that issue, there's the issue of, does the voluntary payment doctrine apply where you have wrongful conduct on the part of the payee, in this case, Time Warner? It's undisputed, and the allegations are in the complaint, that Time Warner engaged in wrongful conduct. In fact, this late payment fee really was not a late payment fee. It's a fee that's charged a month in advance. The cost of late payment is already incorporated into the underlying basic rates. This is the only aspect of the cable system that is not regulated. We have also alleged, and it has to be taken as true, that the billing cycles were designed and implemented by Time Warner to ensure that they snare a significant number of customers into paying this late payment fee. So inequity, which the voluntary payment doctrine is an equitable doctrine, does it apply where you have to take as true wrongful conduct on the part of the payee? We suggest not. Then, as a third matter, there's the question of, does the voluntary payment doctrine apply in this case as a tertiary matter? based on full knowledge. Clearly the law in Wisconsin is that the payor must have full knowledge of all material facts. What could be more material to the determination of whether or not this was an unlawful liquidated damage than what the cost was compared to what they were being charged? And in this case, it's interesting because what the appellate court seemed to say is that, well, we're going to put the onus on the subscribers, your petitioners, to have inquired as to what the cost was. But, oh, by the way, there's no duty to disclose this information, and Time Warner concedes that even if the cable customers had asked, they wouldn't have told them. So, in terms, again, of this being an equitable doctrine, did they have the petitioners' full knowledge of all the facts? We submit clearly the answer is no. And then as a fourth matter before this court is the issue of the court's dismissal of the petitioner's claim for declaratory relief. And it seems the suggestion by the majority at the Court of Appeals was what petitioners really need to do is go back now, even though we've got a situation where we've alleged that the petitioners have paid a late payment fee. They're subject to it in the future. We know because late payment fees are incorporated into the basic cable rates that it's going to happen again. There's no doubt about that at all. But we believe the Court of Appeals has not abided by this court's pronouncements in finding that that issue was not ripe for determination. Apparently, what the Court of Appeals seemed to suggest is that despite the Declaratory Judgment Act and the pronouncements of this court, that what the petitioners have to do is go back and say in a new complaint, I've been charged a late fee, I'm not going to pay a late fee in order to make it right. As Judge Shutson said in his dissent, this dispute is as ripe as an autumn apple. And we submit to the court that the Court of Appeals erred, as did the trial court, in not addressing the issue on the declaratory judgment.
You're not attacking the voluntary payment doctrine, are you?
Not at all, Justice Abramson.
Why not? So it dates back to 1897, when the whole concept, or before, when it was a buyer beware. The whole concept of consumer protection and unequal bargaining power, adhesion contracts, are way after Frederick. Well, maybe not adhesion contracts, but at least the whole concept. Maybe in this 19th century, the concept of free contract would have reigned, liberty of contracts. This seems to me to be a doctrine that might have very limited applicability. I mean, you are claiming unconscionability, breach of implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing, unjust enrichment, restitution, money having received, violation of Wisconsin's trade practice statutes, and equitably accounting, right? I mean, all this is involved. And so, all to be under the doctrine of voluntary payment defeats all that?
I think a couple of comments. The doctrine is an equitable doctrine. I think because it is an equitable doctrine, the court should have looked at, for example, the wrongful conduct and said, given the allegations here, there has to be discovery and it has to come in another posture. Do I like the doctrine? No. Can I think of other circumstances when I think that it shouldn't apply? Of course. For example, let's take a lawyer who meets with a client on an employment case and says, if you want me in your case, it's going to cost $500,000 or $100,000, whatever. And then the next day, the case is thrown out of court on because it's not a claim, and the lawyer's done no work for that fee. Well, we have the ethical rule that says we can't charge an unreasonable fee. So query, should the client in that case be able to challenge the reasonableness of that fee? Or can the lawyer say, wait a minute, you knew voluntary payment doctrine. And I think check on the doctrine is there. Again, you have the lawyer's potential breach of a fiduciary duty in entering into that contract to begin with. And I think the court, in looking at the voluntary payment doctrine, has to take into account those equitable concerns. So for our purposes here today, I don't think it's necessary that the court throw out the voluntary payment doctrine, although that would be fine with me. But in terms of this particular...
I thought you might like
it. I'm sorry. Yes?
I said I thought you might like it.
Yeah, I don't have any problem with it. I'm not going to object to it. All right. But I just want to make the point that here, I think the flaw of the trial court was so basic in terms of allegations of wrongful conduct. Here you have an equitable doctrine. And the trial court really didn't take those allegations of wrongful conduct into account at all in making its equitable determination to apply this doctrine. And clearly the doctrine does not apply where you have wrongful conduct on the part of the payee. And as I said when we started out, I also think that in terms of an unlawful liquidated damage claim, where as a matter of public policy, this court has said that unlawful liquidated damages can't be charged, that it doesn't make sense to say that the voluntary payment doctrine, which is based on reliance, should trump the unlawful liquidated damage claim.
Can you amend your complaint and stay in court after the Court of Appeals decision?
Could we have? We asked the trial court when we had the hearing on the motions to dismiss for leave to amend the complaint, and that was denied at that time. If the court, and specifically I believe it came up in the discussion on the declaratory judgment in terms of how it was framed. So we asked the trial court. We did not review that in light of the Court of Appeals ruling, but we did make that effort initially with the trial court, and that was denied, and we indicated our willingness to do that or desire to do it at the hearing in front of Judge Wells.
Could you bring a new action if the Court of Appeals decision stayed? If the Court of Appeals decision was upheld, can you bring another action?
Yes, I believe we could.
How would you change it?
Given the Court of Appeals pronouncement, I guess there would be a couple ways. Number one, have one of our clients on a late payment fee just write on the check, I protest, and send it in. I guess that would be one way.
But does that get rid of the voluntary payment doctrine?
That seems to be the Court of Appeals' suggestion that would get around it. To me, that seems like kind of a form over substance, exactly, rather than looking at the fact there's a real dispute that we've presented that relates to how the late payment fees are charged, when, how the billing cycles are operated, as well as whether it bears any relationship to the underlying actual cost, and in fact, as we've alleged, is really a double recovery since the cost of late paying customers is already incorporated into the underlying rates.
If I could interrupt for a minute, if a consumer or a taxpayer or someone pays a bill under protest, that gives the recipient of that payment the opportunity to settle the whole matter out of court rather than wait for a class action such as this to be filed.
Well, if this court believes that it's an incumbent on petitioners to advise Time Warner that they're charging an unlawful liquidated damage, if that's where the court believes I'm sorry.
It's standard.
Yeah, I tend to wander. I apologize for that.
Well, the voluntary payment doctrine stands for the proposition that if you've got a dispute about will, you have to notify the other side at the time that you're paying that disputed bill if you're going to go ahead and pay it. Otherwise, it can't come back years later and raise the dispute. So, you know, and part of the rationale for that is because somebody receives money paid under protest, they might not want to accept that. They might want to figure out what the protest is and settle the whole matter before inviting further problems down the road. Right?
Yes. No, I don't agree. I do not agree that the public policy is a company has a right to rely on an unlawful liquidated damage. The interests of a private entity are totally different than the government. A government is assumed and can only act in good faith. A company is very different. A company can act in bad faith. So the question is, is the voluntary payment doctrine, is its public policy to immunize a company from its wrongful conduct? Is it a policy that will be applied by this court to allow a company to charge an unlawful liquidated damage?
Just go over the unlawful conduct for me, just from A to B to C, why you feel, on the other hand, why this is trumping, in this case, the fact that in order to even be here, your client had to be late. In other words, if you paid your bill on time, you wouldn't have a $5 fee. But is this a question of ignorance on the basis? What's the public policy again? Just run over that again. You started out with that, but you didn't give me the underlying premise.
The underlying premise of the unlawful liquidated damage claim is that companies, parties to contract, should not be allowed to charge an unreasonably high penalty.
Who decides the question of reasonability?
The trial court, under the Wassenaar analysis, after fact-finding, it's a mixed question of fact and law that the trial court engages in under Wassenaar. The separate issue is misconduct. And the misconduct that was alleged in the complaint, which we believe we can prove if we're allowed to go forward, is number one, that this isn't a late payment to begin with. It's charged a month in advance. Number two, it's outside the scope of regulation, and through regulation, the cost of late-paying customers is already recovered in the underlying basic cable fee. So they're being allowed to recover twice for the same thing. And then the other aspect of it, which we've alleged, is the design of the billing cycles to snare a significant percent of the customers.
Would you explain what you mean when you say they're charged a month in advance for the late fee? I don't understand.
With cable service, you pay a month in advance. So when your bill comes due...
But you don't pay a late fee in advance.
Excuse me?
You don't pay a late fee in advance. You pay the charge that's set forth by the company.
You pay a late payment fee for your payment that's paying for the next month's cable service.
I guess that's what I wanted you to run over, because that first, I understand the month in advance, but at some point in time there was a payment that was made late, in the sense that the company said it had to be in next, so that was a problem. In other words, that first, it's an advance payment, but then the second payment, or one of those, the second payment was paid late. That's what I'm saying. In order to put this $5 per month fee in the motion.
What's the result if you don't make the payment, the late fee payment?
If you don't make your payments, ultimately you're terminated, and then there would have to be a cost to hook back up, and that's all regulated. Exactly when they terminate, and the and I believe it's 45 days. But
so the customer is told that if you've missed a payment, you have to pay a $5 late fee. If you don't pay the late fee, the customer is told you'll be terminated. Your cable service will be terminated.
Right.
Correct. Suppose I want to start service March 1. Okay.
March 1.
Yeah. When will I get a bill?
You pay in advance.
Okay, so if I make a deal with you with Time Warner tomorrow, I'll get a bill before March 1. Will that bill have a $5 late fee on it?
No. I mean, you pay in advance, so you've already paid for your first month's service when you sign up, when the service guy comes out to your house. And
so now, March, I start the service, and as of the 10th of every month, I get a bill. Following month, so March 10th, I get a bill. Is there a late fee on it?
Yes. If you don't pay by set date, you have
to. No, I'm paying it by the set date.
If you were late last month, the $5 fee is assessed against next month's bill, right?
The $5 late fee is assessed on your advance payment of the next month.
Okay, but it's the late fee for having paid late last month.
I'm sorry.
But it's a late fee for having paid late the last month. I don't get a $5 late fee every month. I only get it if I'm late.
That's true.
And you're objecting to that late fee.
Correct.
Is there an interest on my paying late?
No.
No, so there's just the late fee.
Correct.
And that you think that is an invalid, unliquidated damage, but you haven't had the opportunity to try that. You might lose
Correct.
It. You might win it.
Or do discovery. Or the court did not engage in the Wassenaar factual finding in this case. So,
Counsel, I want to turn to the declaratory judgment issue. The trial court is given discretion to grant or not grant declaratory judgment to determine if something is right or not right for declaratory judgment. A trial court erroneously exercises that discretion if the trial court misapplies the law. Was there any misapplication of the law in the trial court's ruling on declaratory judgment?
I believe so.
What was that?
There was not a lot of discussion in the trial court decision on the declaratory judgment. If you read that, it's about a paragraph or two. So, you know, principally, I would look to the Court of Appeals and its citing overruled law. But what I would say to you, Justice, is that in this case, it's clear that you had a decision or not a decision, a dispute that was active. It was between the parties. It was practically certain and imminent to recur. We have, as I said, they bill into their cable rates, late payment costs.
As I read the trial court's decision, the guts of its decision on declaratory judgment set forth in the appendix, and it's in essence, the trial court says, look, in your complaint, an amended complaint, no one asserted that monies have been paid in. No one asserted that I have a late bill fee, that I've not paid it, and I don't intend to pay it. I've not paid the late fee as well. And had they done that, this is the trial court speaking, they feel the plaintiff would be entitled to a declaratory judgment and a decision, perhaps on injunctive relief. But they haven't done that. When he skips, I skip, and he says, but as presently constituted, neither the complaint nor the amended complaint state that any of the plaintiffs are in that factual posture. I mean that factual posture to be having those averments in the complaint or amended complaint. What's wrong in the law with the trial court exercising its discretion on the basis of the transcript that I read?
I think a couple of things. I think it's telling, number one, that the court wouldn't allow us leave to amend if that was really the way it viewed the situation. And I think number two, in terms of this court's pronouncements on declaratory judgment and the need to be anticipatory, and with the issue being whether or not a controversy is imminent or practically certain to happen, I think that was an erroneous exercise of discretion. I think it wasn't applying this court's law, because on the complaint that was before the court, it was clear that these petitioners had paid late fees, that late fees were going to happen again, that they were threatened with them. And I don't believe, given this court's pronouncements, we had to have a petitioner come in and say, I just got billed again and I don't intend to pay it. But that's my view on this court's cases, and as Judge Schutzen noted in his dissent, I think that Judge Wells failed to be anticipatory of the fact that this was practically certain to happen again with the petitioners and others that were similarly situated.
Judge Schutzen may or may not be correct with regard to the Court of Appeals analysis and being wedded to overruled law, as you paraphrase him, but I'm focusing on the trial court. What the trial court did.
And again, my understanding is that pronouncements of this court can really boil down to, is this the type of happening that is practically certain to happen again? Is it imminent? And there's, in what you read from Judge Wells, he didn't say that this isn't going to happen again. He's not saying it's not practically certain to happen. He's not saying you haven't alleged that, in fact, the Time Warner knows it's going to happen, so they incorporate this into their race. What he says is, even though you have all that, that's not enough. You have to have a petitioner that says, you know, I just got the bill, I'm not going to pay it, I don't intend to pay it. And I don't think that's in accord with the test, which is it imminent, is it practically certain to happen again, and does it make sense that the court handled this in an anticipatory fashion?
Can I ask one final question to you, please? Just as a practical matter, the claims for monetary relief, the dismissal of the claims for monetary relief, is upheld. Will the declaratory judgment portion of the case reverse? Will the case go forward?
If you find that we don't, that it was a proper dismissal on the voluntary payment doctrine.
On the claims for monetary relief.
On the claims.
Will there be anything left of the declaratory judgment? If there was an error or an abuse of discretion on a declaratory judgment issue.
I would say yes, because I can't imagine the determination on the unlawful liquidated damages being made without a Wassenaar hearing, as this court said you must, or this court said the trial court must.
Well, can you do that under a declaratory judgment?
Correct.
Mr. Friedberg, representing Time Warner Cable.
Good afternoon. My name is Robert Friebert, and I represent Time Warner Cable. With me at council table is Jeremy Levinson. I think we've resolved that the voluntary payment doctrine is not under attack here directly, but I think it is under attack by the presentation that is made. Under the position set forth, it would disappear overnight. The fact of the matter is, every plaintiff who's paid a bill, who comes into court and says, I want my money back, has a theory. And the theory is, it's unlawful. It's too much. It's whatever the theory is, the claim is always made and has to be made that I paid and I want my money back, and then there's a theory. Because you just can't come in and say, I paid and I want my money back. That doesn't get you anywhere. You always have to have a theory. So what is the theory that the law allows for money had and received? That's a very old common law claim. And it's the same as the claim for tort and satisfaction. These are flip sides of the same common law claims. And that is, you can get your money back if you've been a victim of a fraud, not some nebulous wrongdoing, a fraud, a mistake of fact, or duress. And that's the way the voluntary payment doctrine has developed. Now, there is no duress in this case. I haven't heard it argued in a long time now. And there really is no fraud in this case, because nothing alleged in this case has anything to do with what Time Warner said or represented to any of these plaintiffs. It's all internalized. All the facts are in the case are the plaintiff signed a contract, and they knew that if they paid late, there'd be a $5 late fee. They got their bill. They knew the due date. They paid late. They incurred the fee. They paid the fee. And now, years later, they say, we want our money back. Not just 6 years ago, but all the way back, perhaps 15 years, since they say that even the statute of limitations doesn't apply here. Well, what didn't the plaintiffs allege? They did not allege that they objected to the fee. They didn't allege they made any inquiry about the fee. They didn't allege that Time Warner refused to provide any information. And all we've ever argued is that we have no duty to provide information before being asked, because there is no obligation to tell what makes up our charges as any other business.
Can I just ask you a question? Let us suppose that tomorrow, and if I were a Time Warner subscriber, I don't pay the $5, and I send in my bill and a letter with copies to everybody in the world that I object to this $5 fee. I'm not paying it. I think it's unlawful. And I'm going to sue you. You turn off my subscription, I'm suing you. I even sue you if you don't turn off my subscription. Can I have a lawsuit against you?
If you don't pay the $5, and the thing that, of course, we're dealing with a motion to dismiss, if this is the first time, Chief Justice Abramson, after a 10-year history with the company where you got a late fee and you don't pay it, I doubt that the company would actually keep that bill there. But assume that they're that kind of company, they don't care about their customers at all, you would, and assume the company said, which hasn't happened yet, but they say, unless you pay, we're going to shut off your service. Yes, if that were the fact, you'd have a claim for declaratory judgment.
As to the validity of the $5,
yes.
If they don't shut it off and I can just continue not paying my $5, then I have nothing to sue about, right? Because I'm not damaged. Maybe I could sue anyway because there's a threat that you're going to turn.
If they've threatened to disconnect you.
So I can sue you. I just want to see whether or not Time Warner can ever be sued.
Sure they can.
Okay. That's what
they
I'm
can be sued. They can be sued under the fact situation which you've presented.
Right. And in terms of being shocked by the fact that there's a lawsuit about $5, how many times has Time Warner been sued on this?
In Wisconsin?
Anywhere
this is
in the country.
I think there are, we've cited about a half a dozen cases and more than that. And in practically every case has ultimately resulted in the dismissal of the case because of a voluntary payment doctrine. Just a few cases the other way.
The real concern here is $5 times a lot of customers times a lot of years is a lot of money.
Of course it is, and there's also a lot of reliance on the money over all those years. I mean, the fact of the matter is, if somebody pays a bill, which is the whole background of the doctrine, if somebody pays a bill and doesn't register any objection, the person receives the money properly, can believe that they could spend it. And otherwise, and they've done, there's no fraud. Fraud's a different animal, but we don't have that here.
I just wanted to ask opposing counsel a similar question, but he started out on public policy. Why does this ban from public policy? Let's say, for example, does the size of the late fee make any difference? Say it was $50. $50 late fee and you lose your cable TV in 10 days. Don't pay it. Now, would that make any difference?
The size, if a person actually pays it without objection, it ought not make a difference if they paid without objection. In the same way as somebody pays an unconstitutional tax or a tax that is exempt, the voluntary payment doctrine works the same way. But there are policy reasons.
Mr. Freeberg, could I ask you a question? From time to time, I have received telephone bills that say you get a credit of some kind because of overpayment as a class. But what is the theory involved in that in relation to the voluntary payment doctrine?
Well, I think a discount for early payment is the same animal with a different name. If you pay after this date, you have a fee, the difference, which is a late payment charge. It's just another way of saying the same thing. It's the same thing as, this is not just here. Many people pay rent in advance, and there's a late charge for the late fee, and it can be $30, $50. All of these come into question. Where does this line get drawn once we start blurring the line on the voluntary payment doctrine?
I didn't understand the answer to your question. From time to time, I have had a reduction in my telephone bill, allegedly, because somehow I overpaid in the past as one of hundreds of thousands of consumers. I didn't know I overpaid. I didn't object. Whoever did this for me, what was the theory they were working on?
Well, I don't know. I guess I've never gotten a bill like that. And but I would think that I need to get the other kind, underpaid. So I don't know the exact circumstances that you're referring to.
Could an administrative agency say to the company,
yes,
you've overcharged on the basis of whatever the rate schedule is?
It could be that or something else. It could be...
class action.
But class action based upon some type of fraudulent conduct, which we do not have here. mean, it's very loose commentary. They did, they bad, they're bad, they did something wrong. I mean, anybody can allege some kind of theory of wrongfulness and come into court and get around the voluntary payment on it. It's got to be actionable fraud. And that's not alleged here. And it has to be particularity, and that's not here at all.
Does it have to be fraud? Oh,
Would it have to be some form of fraud or duress claim if the consumers didn't object? Is that true?
Mistake of fact is the other way to that the common law has allowed avoidance of the voluntary payment doctrine. A mistake of fact has a specific Wisconsin definition. And it's not wrong. The definition is forgetfulness. It's your mistake is that you forgot. The classic case is amalgamated, cited in the brief, which the person doubled paid. And they forgot they had paid previously. And that's a classic mistake of fact. And that brings me into
Here, the plaintiffs alleged that there was at least wrongful conduct, if not unlawful conduct, in two respects. One, that their billing, their approved billing already took into account late payment fees, and therefore this was essentially unjust enrichment or something tantamount to it. And secondly, that the billing cycles were designed to snare people into making these. Now, are you saying this rings of fraud to me, but it might not be fraud, but nevertheless, I think it could well be unlawful conduct. And so the question then becomes whether or not the voluntary payment doctrine does apply. How do you respond to that? Because he
sure
did allege that. They
pled a conclusion. Mistake of fact, a mistake or fraud has to be pled with particularity. What do they plead? They set up a billing cycle that snares people. Well, what is that billing cycle? Is it you get the bill after the due date? You get the bill 2 months before the due date? 1 week before the due date? What are the facts? And they should allege the facts, not their conclusion. So I think that is not an appropriate pleading. It's all conclusory. In addition, not one of these plaintiffs said that's the reason they paid late. None of them said that. All they said is that sometime in the distant past, they got a bill and they paid it. They don't say when in the past. Was it last week? Was it 5 years ago? Was it 8 years ago? They paid late at some point in the past. They don't say why they paid late. Were they ensnared by this? Did they say that the reason I paid late is because I got the bill one day before it was due? They don't say any of that. They just throw this stuff out at us. Now, with respect to the second part of the question, which is that it's the claim being made, which we dispute, but that's besides the point. We can't dispute it here. It's in the complaint. That it's somehow part of the base rate, which is the only rate, by the way, that is regulated in the entire industry. My response to that is that's just another way of saying that it's a overcharge under Wassenaar. But Wassenaar says, and to me it looks more like a situation just like Wassenaar, who went out and got another job. But just because Wassenaar was able to recover money from a different source did not result in the fact that the amount of the liquidated damages would be appropriate or wasn't appropriate. It was not allowed to detract from that. And beyond that, how companies cost account for things. I'd like to make another point on that. The wrongdoer in this case is the party who breached the contract and paid late, who didn't pay on time. They had an agreement to pay by a certain date. They shouldn't benefit from the fact that the company is able to recover costs in a different way. It's almost like a collateral source theory. They paid late, undeniably, because of people who pay late, the company is required to expend money. So the late payers cause the expenditure of funds by the company. The fact that the company is able to obtain relief in a different way does not mean the wrongdoers who breached and paid late should benefit. And those are my answers to your inquiries.
Counsel, I'd like to turn it also with you to the declaratory judgment. Oftentimes I see a declaratory judgment being rights declared. You know, they don't know under an insurance policy if they should pay. You go in and ask. They don't know in a business dealing if this contract provision really covers something. And so the two business people go in and say, no wrong has happened, but declare our rights. What does this mean? An argument is made that the trial court, in exercising its judgment, seemed to require that a wrong be averred, that they had to say that they hadn't paid it. I've not paid the late fee. And had they done this, the plaintiff might be entitled to declaratory judgment. Is that a misapplication of law by the trial court, and if not, why not?
I think Judge Wells properly exercised his discretion and held, even though he said, used the word right, that the controversy was not yet justiciable. And the reason is that and the review is still improper, erroneous exercise of discretion.
Softer.
With the same, I believe, the same general meaning. What we have is a controversy that is a remote and uncertain. And that is, it depends upon, and everybody wants to think that this is a class action. It isn't a class action. It's asked to be a class action. Right now, there are just a few plaintiffs in the case. And you don't need a class action for declaratory judgment. One person can come in and controvert the $5. Now, what about that one person? Whether that one person will ever have an injury or not, in the posture of this case, is uncertain, because it depends upon what the person does and how the company reacts to what that person does.
Why isn't that true when business person A is making widgets and business person B is buying them and there's a contract and they want to then go into court and say, declare our rights? Well, maybe business person A decides later on, gee, my son's going to marry his niece, so I don't want to pursue it. You know, there's going to be no wrong there. You don't want to go forward with it. But is there a requirement in the law that there be a wrong before you can proceed with a declaratory judgment to have your rights declared?
There's a requirement under Loy that the injury not be remote or uncertain. And this court has overturned some declaratory judgment cases, and where the declaratory judgment has been issued because it wasn't, because it was remote and uncertain, and it's gone the other way. But the test is that even if you would disagree with Judge Wells, still, if Judge Wells exercised his discretion appropriately, even if you disagree, he has to be affirmed. Now, in this case, why is the injury uncertain? Because we don't know from this complaint what these plaintiffs, not 1,000 people, these people plan to do. We don't know if they'll ever pay late again. We don't know if they'll keep cable. We don't know if they'll go to a satellite dish. We don't know if they'll go to a movie, or we don't know if they'll read a book. I don't know.
I don't know if I'm going to do any of those until I know whether I'm going to be liable for the $5 late fee.
Well, and depending upon what you do, what they do, Chief Justice, will also have a reaction by the company. And that's the other side of the facts that they can't say. So it's not yet there. For example, as I said, I've paid all the time on time, and I call and complain. I miss this, and is the company going to hold to it, or are they going to forgive the $5? That's out of their control, and it's not right yet. In that sense, because we don't know if the injury is certain. If they write in, how will the company react? Will the company actually sue for the money? We don't have any case where that's happened.
Do they have
off the service?
Do they have the right to sue? Do they have the right to cut off service under the contract?
The right is regulated by statute.
Okay.
And as it was alluded to, 100.209, and that is they cannot cut off service for 45 days after the due date.
But it can cut off service.
Yes.
And it can sue for money.
It can.
Okay.
But they haven't really said that they're going to put themselves into that position again.
I want to go back to Justice Babich's point. If the charge is illegal, maybe there would be a statute that said this is illegal, and I'll give you an example. If the charge is illegal and I pay it, may I still sue for it back under the voluntary payment doctrine, or will I be barred? I think that was your question.
Well, the court has said, in the context of the Court of Appeals in Heilman, relying on this court decision, and that if a charge is unconstitutional, pretty illegal, you can't get it back if you paid it.
But that's the tax case.
Yes, an unconstitutional act by the government is subject to the voluntary payment doctrine.
Tax cases are always a little different.
I'm not sure this doctrine started with the private sector and was brought into the tax sector. And I would think that that's pretty illegal to answer your question. But are you saying that the legislature declared it illegal?
Let me give you a case that when I was in practice, I, representing a client, sued a retail department store. And the statute declared interest in excess of, I think then it was 6%, illegal. And that you could not only get your money back, but keep the merchandise too, if it was that form. And the department stores right around the country, but also in Wisconsin, were charging an 18% revolving interest rate.
Yeah.
And the issue was whether or not that was usurious or that there was a different, that it was not usury at all for any number of reasons. So there you have a declaration of illegality on the usury statute. And suppose I could show usury. The fact that I paid the bill, would that have meant I can't get it back?
First of all,
and let's assume that in the usury statute there's not a remedy set forth.
Well, first of all, what I think has been hit upon is that is a legislative remedy,
No remedy, just saying it's usury.
The usury statute provides a private right, a private claim. Under the usury laws, it provides that you get your money back, you get interest, and you get your cost of attorney's fees.
Suppose that wasn't part of it, just said usury over 6% illegal.
Then we're into a wholly different area of whether the legislature intended to create a private right of action, a whole different subject of...
But let's just get to the fact, I'm pinpointing Justice Bowman's question. It's illegal. Let alone all the other defenses you might have, will the voluntary payment doctrine stop the lawsuit? That's what I'm...
Illegal by legislative...
Yes. Yes.
It depends on whether the legislature, in creating the illegality, created a private right of action, or whether it, in its procedure, allowed an administrative solution. I've actually lost a case like that where I thought I had a private right of action in the Seventh Circuit, where they said I didn't have a private, my client did not have a private right of action, even though the conduct alleged was illegal.
Well, what if in this case they could prove, the plaintiffs could prove that the rate set by the commission, whoever, the cable commission, did already take into account late fees were going to be part of the cost of doing business.
Well, I have to assume that they can do that.
Right, we have to assume that. Now, are you saying that, okay, assuming that they could prove this, wouldn't that be unlawful for Time Warner to charge over and above what they are allowed to charge?
No. I mean, there is nothing within... Unless they showed that there was something that the regulatory agency, by the way, it's not true, but we have to accept that it's true for this motion.
Yeah.
And that is just because you can put that into a rate determination that's regulated, it doesn't follow that you can't charge the late fee to the... These are very complicated cost accounting issues, as I indicated in response to your question before. The company would not incur these charges but for people like these plaintiffs who pay late. And they should not get the benefit of the fact that under a FCC regulation, we're able to charge everybody in the system for this, assuming that that's what happened, which I have to do. They shouldn't get that benefit. They create the costs.
Well, let's assume, as I once did, own a little cable company for about a week. But let's assume that there's this little cable company up in Rhinelander. And they are allowed by the rate, whatever it is, they're allowed to charge $19 a month for basic service. Okay, that's the rate that's been ceilinged in. And so, but instead the Rhinelander company, the cable company up there, charges for basic service $21. And I get the bill for $21 and I pay it. Now, that's unlawful, because they're charging $2 more than what they've been told they can. But I have voluntarily paid it. Am I barred by the voluntary payment doctrine from going after them?
If Congress intended to allow, by that regulation, a private right of action, yes. If Congress intended not to allow private right of action, no. Now, having said that, it's an incredibly complicated question. Boil down to that. It depends upon the intent of Congress. You certainly would have the right to complain to the FCC. You certainly would have the right to complain to your congressman or woman. You certainly have a right to go to the Attorney General, the Ag Department, and the Franchising Authority and complain. And I'll bet there'd be a lot of relief within those agencies if that happened. But we're not dealing with that kind of a situation here. We're dealing with nothing that clean cut. We are dealing with a $5 fee being charged to the people who caused the company to expend money to collect late payments. That's what we're dealing with. And the people who caused it should pay for it, even if the company can get it back on the base rate, get it back on an unregulated rate, can kick up HBO by $2 a month, can charge. I mean, how a cost accountant looks at it is not really the issue. These are the people who cause the expenditures, and whether the company is able to find other ways to get that income doesn't get them off the hook, nor should it. I think that would be bad public policy, because that would encourage people to not honor their deals or their contracts. There's one other thing that I need to get to as my time is running out. And that is the broad statement that this is an equitable claim. It is not an equitable claim. This is a claim at law for money had and received. And the principal case on this is Amalgamated, which is cited with approval in Heilman. And it has been cited many times. And I want to be careful on this. There is an equitable portion to it, but it's not a sword, it's a shield. The equitable portion is only a defense. Once you get past the doctrine, assuming you get past the doctrine, then the defendant can say, in equity, we shouldn't pay the money back because of this reason. But it doesn't get you past the claim. Amalgamated is the perfect case to demonstrate this. Amalgamated, if I may finish, was a double payment of $200 and $200 by the union. They'd forgotten that they had paid before. They sued to get the $200 back. It's a clear mistake of fact. You're past the doctrine. But the widow, in this case, had spent $50 of the $200 on the second one in reasonable reliance. It was at that point, only as a defense, that equity came into play, and the union could only get $150 back. Equity is a defense after you get past the voluntary payment doctrine. It is a shield, a defense. It is not a sword. And it's been used very loosely in the opening argument. I wanted to make that point. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Friedrich. Mr. Cavanaugh?
Thank you. With all due respect, I didn't use it loosely at all. This is an equitable action. An unlawful liquidated damage claim is equitable. The right to recover that is in restitution. It's black letter law in the restatement of restitution. This is not an action for money had and received. And I think that is a key point for this court and kind of crystallizes it. Because what we have here is Time Warner concedes for purposes of the issues before this court. This is an unlawful liquidated damage provision. It must concede for purposes of this case and how it came to this court that it engaged in wrongful conduct. But it says, oh no, we can do that on a money had and received claim because it knows the basic premise. If you're going to do equity, if you're going to get equity, you have to do equity. You have to have clean hands. Time Warner is not entitled to invoke the voluntary payment doctrine in this case, among other reasons, because of its wrongful conduct. It's not just, it is an equitable doctrine. It does not just apply with fraud and duress or coercion, but it also cannot be invoked when a payee has engaged in wrongful conduct.
Just wrongful or unlawful?
Wrongful. If
well,
it
that
does
can be
not
in the
have,
eyes of the beholder.
Excuse me?
That can be wrongful conduct, can be in the eyes of the beholder.
And
lawful conduct at least assumes that there's a cause of action or a statutory prohibition or something.
I think we could envision circumstances where you have an unlawful liquidated damage claim, for example, without wrongful conduct. I agree that they're two different concepts. And the number one issue that I presented to this court is whether or not the voluntary payment doctrine can apply as a matter of public policy under any circumstance where you have an unlawful liquidated damage claim. My number two position and argument to this court is, regardless of how the court decides that issue, where you have a payee who's engaged in wrongful conduct as distinct from imposing an unlawful liquidated damage, that that party cannot come in and in equity invoke the voluntary payment doctrine. And here, there was no, in fact, I think it was incumbent upon the trial court in invoking the wrongful or the voluntary payment doctrine in this case. It should have allowed discovery on the allegations of wrongful conduct and should have made a determination. And again, that is because to invoke this equitable doctrine, one must have clean hands. I mean, Time Warner would have this court decide that, right, we're charging an unlawful liquidated damage. We've engaged in wrongful conduct. But once you pay the money, neener, 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 you can't do anything to get it. We got it. And as a matter of public policy, we have a right to rely on our ill-gotten gains that are unlawful, that we knew as a matter of law we shouldn't charge. That just flies in the face of the whole concept of equity and clean hands, in my opinion. Also, another aspect of this, and it goes hand in hand with the concept of clean hands, and that is in every contract there's an implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing. And clearly, Time Warner had that obligation to act in good faith. And query, again, is it entitled to the protections of the voluntary payment doctrine with allegations that has acted, in effect, in bad faith?
Counsel, I'm having a difficult time distinguishing in my own mind the difference or the distinction between the first basis for your argument and the second basis. First basis, as I understand it, is you are arguing that the voluntary payment doctrine does not apply in the face of unlawful liquidated damages.
Correct.
And the second argument you seem to be saying is that the voluntary payment doctrine does not apply in the face of unlawful conduct.
Wrongful conduct.
Or wrongful conduct. Well, isn't unlawful liquidated damages wrongful conduct?
Most of the time, yes. I think there are circumstances you could conceive of where unlawful liquidated damages were imposed negligently as opposed to as a matter of intent or design or scheme. But I believe that most of the time that, in fact, the two would be synonymous. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kavanagh. Thank you, Mr. Friedberg, for your arguments. Afternoon, this concludes 99-27. Board is in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:45.